This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Our leadoff guest for the week is Connie Mack, former U.S. Senator from the great state of Florida, a crusader against cancer, a dedicated father. He's had many titles throughout his life and career, but his title of choice remains Citizen, and that is the title of his book, Citizen Mack, Politics and Honorable Calling. And he is a man who knows his way around the Beltway, but he left the U.S. Senate in 2001, U.S. Senator from Florida for two terms, 1989 to 2001. So he was there through the presidencies of George Bush number one, and Bill Clinton. And he also served in the U.S. House before that from 1983 to 1989. So he was there in the years when Newt Gingrich was making a name for himself and ultimately became the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. He's got quite a story that's detailed in his book. Also the grandson of the late great manager of the Philadelphia Athletics. He managed the A's for 50 years, Cornelius McGillicuddy I. And we're speaking with Cornelius McGillicuddy III. And good morning to you, Connie Mack.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for that introduction. I appreciate the interest in the book, too. Thank you.
Well, the book is about your life, which is remarkable, and you've related to more than one famous person. It is interesting that not many people have the pedigree that you, Senator.
Well, I'm a very blessed man. My grandparents on both sides of the family, my parents, very special people, gave me an opportunity in life, and it's been a grand one. So my grandfather's on my mother's side in the Senate, and when he died in 1941, he was the dean of the United States Senate, Morris Shepherd. And I had his step-grandfather, who was Tom Connally, who was another senator from Texas. So really quite a background, but and eventually led me to a life in politics.
Well, you note about the way things have changed, and you say when you became a U.S. senator in January of 1989, you said you asked Senator Bob Graham, a Democrat, to escort you down the well of the Senate to be sworn in. It seemed appropriate, writes Senator Mack, because back in 1981, when Paula Hawkins had been sworn in as a Republican senator from Florida, she refused to have Lawton Chiles, a Democrat and the state's other senator, escort her down the aisle. Partisan feelings were that strong and even that bitter back then, and this was something that I wanted to get beyond so that on issues that were more important to Florida, Bob and I would be able to work together. That would be a win all the way around for Bob, for me, and for the state. And Bob agreed to it. Now, today, let's say if Bill Cassidy in Louisiana were unseated by a Democrat, I doubt that John Kennedy, the Republican, would be walking the Democrat down the aisle to become a U.S. senator. Why is there so much friction today in the halls of Congress?
Well, Jim, you know, history tells us that there's always been friction in the halls of Congress, and I suspect it's just based on the fact that we're human beings. Human nature is such. So I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that Senator Kennedy wouldn't invite or be part of escorting a new senator down the aisle. Let's hope that he would. If I could expand on that story with Bob Graham for just a minute, though. During the campaign in '88, Bob Graham called me an ideological wacko. It was frankly a little bit of a shock to see the sitting senator become that engaged in that election cycle. But again, my feeling was that when I won, the first thing I did was go by Senator Graham's office, and we sat down, we talked. I told him, I said, look, I understand that there are just things that happened that we wish maybe that it hadn't happened. And so as far as I'm concerned, that's behind us, and let's you and I make a commitment to work together. And the great thing about it was that our staffs worked extremely closely together. For example, when we had the Everglades legislation passed, our staffs were inseparable and probably couldn't have gotten that legislation done if it hadn't been for that kind of environment that we were working in.
Well, you are a guy who wasn't considered to be an ideologue, but nonetheless, you have a great friendship that you note with Newt Gingrich. But despite your friendship, do you think he, on the whole, was good for our country by the way he served as Speaker of the House?
Well, you know, the answer is absolutely yes. Newt and I are very close, and I got involved with Newt back in 83, and I am so proud of that relationship and that involvement. Yes, he's a controversial figure, no doubt about it, but he is a patriot, and has always acted in the best interest of the country. So, it was a great experience to work with Newt during those years in the House.
As I note, you weren't regarded as an ideologue, but certainly a conservative. And, for example, on the Clarence Thomas vote in 1991, both Louisiana senators, Democrats, Johnston and Breaux, voted for him, meaning that today, if they were around in politics, they might very well be Republicans. To give you a contrast, Arkansas, one state above, both Democratic senators, Bumpers and Pryor, voted against Clarence Thomas. You voted right for him. Do you think that was a good vote?
I do. I've gotten to know Clarence Thomas over the years. I'm very proud of him. He is a person serving as a justice of the Supreme Court in a tremendous manner, in the sense that he believes in strict construction of the Constitution, and is not an activist judge, and so very proud of him. Yes, I'm also proud of the fact that that Breaux and Johnston voted for him as well. It was a very contentious set of hearings, and it left many people in the country with some very bad feelings. I remember my father said to me, as I was walking with him one morning while I was home in Florida, and this was during the hearings, and my father said to me, I never would have thought I would have said I'm embarrassed to have a son in the United States Senate. So it was that was a tough comment, but I understood the feeling that he had about what was going on.
Well, you served with Joe Biden in the Senate on the opposite aisle, of course. But what's your thought about the presidential election? Will you be a partisan in the election that is 8 weeks from today?
Well, let's put it this way. I have been very much out of politics for at least the last 10 years and was not really too engaged, in the previous 10 years. But I will not be active in the campaign in these next 2 months. I am a partisan in the sense that I believe the ideas of President Trump and the Republican Party much more closely relate to what I believe in and what I hope the future of our country will be than with Joe Biden. Joe and I disagree probably on 95-96% of the issues that came before us in the Senate. I'm a supporter of President Trump, but I'm not going to be active. You know, I'll be 80 years old next month, and it's time to step back and observe as opposed to participate.
The book is Citizen Mac from Senator Connie Mack. You were there in the Senate for the impeachment trial and voted for the impeachment, for the articles of impeachment that were passed by the House, voted for conviction of President William Jefferson Clinton. But you do note that your former colleague Dale Bumpers, who was Bill Clinton's defender, the man who gave his defense, made an impression on you. Was it a close call, or did you just like what Bumper said and how he presented himself?
Yeah, I liked what he said and how he presented himself. But it was not a close call for me. I felt that the two articles that we voted on, that the president was guilty of, and so it wasn't a difficult decision. But the whole process was just distasteful as you can imagine. It was just to see the country drawn through this impeachment process was hurtful, as it was just not a long time ago with the impeachment process for President Trump.
The book is Citizen Mac from Senator Connie Mack. We only have a few seconds left, but you're old enough to remember your grandfather.
That's true. I was 16 years old when he died, and I had a wonderful experience with him. Certainly a great, great baseball man and a great American.
And I think most people would concur that Senator Connie Mack represented himself and his state well and is a great American from the conservative side of the political spectrum. His book is Citizen Mac. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your interest, Jim.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And the Reverend Chris Andrews is with us for more than 20 years. He was pastor at First United Methodist downtown in Baton Rouge, and he is now involved with Jubilee Pioneers and also has been a stalwart in trying to rebuild North Baton Rouge. And he spends a lot of quality time in North Baton Rouge, in which few white Louisiana citizens do, and it's unfortunate, but Chris Andrews does so, and he's doing our best, or his best, to make our city a better place. And your number, if you'd like to talk with Reverend Andrews, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org for emails. Now, when we visited last with Chris Andrews, the COVID era had just begun, and I remember, Reverend Andrews, you said we should take to mind the acronym FEAR, F-E-A-R. We can either fear everything and run or face everything and rise. How are we doing?
Well, good morning, Jim. It's hard to say. I think in some places we are fearing everything and running, particularly in the political realm. But there have been some who have risen to do wonderfully heroic things for the benefit of others and for the good of the world. So, you know, it's a yin and yang. We're in between.
Well, right now in the United States, we have 193,595 people who've died of COVID-19, according to the Centers for Disease Control, including 5,105 in Louisiana. So we have eclipsed the 5,000 mark in our state, and that's notable because it's now at a point where most of us know somebody who has died of COVID-19, and this will continue for a while, and we are really uncertain about where we're going. What advice do you have to people who are afraid right now?
Well, I think, you know, sometimes fear is a very wise emotion to have. It means you're aware of reality. So I think what we need to do is to be aware of what is going on, that we are all vulnerable. Our world is been rocked by this. On the other side of that, though, to be as supportive and as connected as we can to both our loved ones as well as people that we don't know, and to realize we're all in this boat together. You know, there's a verse in the letter of 1 John that says, "Perfect love cast out fear," but fear can cast out love, and I think that there is a great deal of fear, and it can make people terribly suspicious of one another, and of feeds the rumor mill, and it provides fodder for those who like to sow untruth. And that's the kind of thing that I think people have to be on guard about, that kind of fear, because that's toxic fear. There's a healthy fear sometimes that makes us preserve ourselves and enables us to preserve ourselves, but the toxic fear is a deadly thing. So I would ask people to open their eyes, to look at the truth with some objectivity, to avail themselves of the best information possible, and every once in a while to turn off all the news and what have you and take a deep breath and realize that this still is a beautiful and holy world.
Well, you've noted on this show you have crossed the 70-year age mark, and you, of course, are living life as best you can in these times. But Chris Andrews, you've had to take precautions like most of the rest of us. we're trying to do our best. We know we're not immune from this. Maybe some of us have more resistance than others, but what's your take on how it's affected you?
Well, it certainly limited my activities in terms of social interaction. My Jubilee Pioneers does not meet now, except virtually. We do it by Zoom and Facebook. My wife and I have been very deliberate about not going out for social occasions. We, don't eat out, and it's something we've enjoyed over the years of doing. So it's affected us. On the other side of that, it's affected us in some good ways in that we've spent more time together. We've had quality time to be in our home. We've enjoyed, the slower pace. So wearing a mask is not fun, but it's something that we accept that we need to do, both for our own benefit and for the benefit of others that we might encounter. And, we do that judiciously, and we just try to, and we carry hand sanitizer in the car, and we do all of the things that we've been told that we need to do. And hopefully that puts a wall of protection around us. But the truth is, I think we're all so vulnerable to this. It is a pandemic. I mean, it's worldwide, and it's everywhere. And we've been fortunate thus far to avoid being diagnosed with it, but it has affected us, mm-hmm. without a doubt.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org if you'd like to engage the Reverend Chris Andrews. And Ari in Prairieville asks about something we've talked about on this show with the pandemic and riots in the streets and all the calamities that have happened, weather-related. Look what happened to Lake Charles down in California and the West Coast, going all the way up to Washington, wildfires in Denver today. The temperature is dropping to 30 degrees, and there will be a snowstorm on a day that is one day removed from almost 100-degree heat in the same city. Do you think we're at the end of our rope?
It does. I chuckle because this is beyond the pale. It's almost unbelievable. It looks like the apocalypse. But I'm not an end time kind of person. I just think that we may be facing a moment in history when the chickens have come home to roost. We have lived large and wild and selfish lives, particularly in the Western world. We've paid no attention in many instances to what we do with the earth and the consequences of our actions, negatively or positively, mostly negative, in our never-ending quest for growth and for consumption. And, here we are. We've got a world that has got everything in it, I think, miraculously, given to make life and to preserve life and to provide for life, but we got to be good stewards of it, and we certainly have not been. And I think these natural calamities that we're seeing, from Hurricane Laura to the fires to the upheaval of weather in the West that you referenced with the snow and everything, it's us. We need to look in the mirror. I think we're largely responsible for a lot of this, and I don't have the. Obviously, no one has all of the answers, but we could all be better stewards of the good world that God has given us and tend to mm-hmm. it. It is a living, breathing thing, this earth. We've objectified it and consider it to be some kind of a piece of material that can be treated in any way we feel we want to treat it, and you can't do that any more than I can, treat another human being as just some piece of objective thing out there that's there for my own enhancement or further my goals at the neglect and the degradation of the other person. The earth's the same way.
877-217-5757. We've got some emails at talk@talklouisiana.org, and a listener asked us to get Reverend Andrews' comments about what Carl Reiner said yesterday in an Encore interview in 2012 about not believing in a life after this one, and we'll do that after we go to the break. But What about, and this is a good one, a covenant marriage. The listener says we're coming up on 25 years of covenant marriage in Louisiana, the first state to have this. You were out there back in the day saying this is a terrible thing. Do you still hold that opinion?
Yeah, I do. I mean, a terrible may be too strong a word. If people somehow feel like it's, you know, something they want to do, like they certainly have the right and the freedom to do it. The reason I was never a proponent of this is because it involves the state getting into the place of where the faith community is, and the two don't match up very well.
We're going to get more on that from Chris Andrews. Should the state be involved in marriages at all? 877-217-5757, talk at talklouisiana.org. And also, I know many of you are listening tonight at 9 o'clock on our show, so we're glad you're doing that. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Reverend Chris Andrews is with us. 877-217-5757 is your number. And talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. Louisiana passed the covenant marriage law in 1997. Shortly thereafter, Arkansas and Arizona followed. And under the procedure, prior to entering into a covenant marriage, a couple must attend premarital counseling sessions emphasizing the nature, purpose, and responsibilities of marriage, and must sign a statement declaring that a covenant marriage is for life. And it basically is one that's hard to get out of if you're in. And Reverend Andrews, when we went to the break, asked about this by a listener, Ari in Prairieville, said that he didn't think the state should be involved in marriage at all. So how would that work if the state didn't keep marriage records and such? How would we proceed as we know it?
Well, you know, the state does keep records, and we do have community property, and those are real issues. What I'm talking about, Jim, is at a deeper, more sacred level of what makes a marriage. It's not the piece of paper that someone signs, and it shouldn't be the state saying, now you are married. A marriage is a covenant of love that in the deepest and most holy and most mysterious ways is formed when the words that people share in that moment are exchanged. This is difficult for me to find good imagery to make it sensible, but the creation story, we're told that God spoke and something came to be. That's what marriage is in the most sacred and divine sense of it. People speak. In that moment, they are given a godlike power, the power of creation, and they create the marriage. They create the family. The state doesn't have any role to play there other than keeping track of property. And it should never, in my opinion, have injected itself into a type of, now we've got a defined type of marriage called covenant marriage, mm-hmm. which is a beautiful word, covenant, sacred and holy word, but its parameters are defined by the state. That doesn't have any bearing for me. As a minister, I signed marriage licenses because I was supposed to, but I always said I never would sign a marriage license. And if it wouldn't be for the inconvenience of the people, I would never sign one, because that's not what makes a marriage. A marriage is indeed a covenant between people in the deepest, holiest interaction mm-hmm. that human beings can have. I hope that makes some sense.
All right.
That's why
Well, we will go to the phone lines and take a call or two, maybe three, for Chris Andrews before we part company with him. But I did want to have you comment on what a listener suggested. Yesterday, we did an encore interview on Labor Day with Carl Reiner, who died in June. Great man, great life, died at 98. But a man who was a non-believer, not an agnostic, an open atheist. And here is how he described his non-belief in 2012, which we replayed yesterday.
You haven't wavered on your atheism.
Am I atheist? No, I've even gotten stronger. As a matter of fact, I get I know that people get a lot of solace from believing that there is a hereafter, and you know, I'm glad that people find ways to make themselves comfortable on this earth. But the way I found myself comfortable is make yourself a good life while you're living it. The people who were, you know, the people who were needing somebody else are usually not having as good a life as they would want in on this earth. And you know, well, it's not hard to become an atheist when you realize we went through a war. By the way, they found out that during that war, and when Hitler decided to kill off millions of people, there were many, many more millions than we thought. There was a new somebody found some more records of the deaths, and they said, anyway, and I'm saying, if there was a God, all these 18 million people, 20, 30 million people, all imploring God to save them, help them, I said, what was he doing? What was he busy making flowers? What was it? You know, I mean, if you want to go along with the idea that there is a supreme being, he certainly was, as Woody Allen said, if there is a God, he was an underachiever.
That was Carl Reiner. Your thoughts, Reverend Andrews?
Jim, I'm sorry. I didn't hear any of that.
Well, I'm sorry. He was saying that with all the people who begged for mercy, and he mentioned the Holocaust, and God is, of course, at that point, not answering to the point of stopping it. That in his mind is cause for the belief that there is no higher power. And he quoted Woody Allen as saying that there is a God, he's an underachiever. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I think that believe or not believe, I certainly believe in God and in God's love for all of us. And I think that, you know, it is a reality that holds us at every moment, whether we are conscious of that or unconscious of it, whether we want to deny it or accept it, it is the truth, as I understand life. And to people like Mr. Reiner, I have no, you know, ill will toward him for the theology that he expressed, which was a theology of maybe not believing, at least in an orthodox sense, in an afterlife and what have you, though I didn't really hear his comments. It still does not change, in my opinion and worldview, the fact that God loves Carl Reiner, loved him in this world, and has loved him in the mystery of his passing. And I never have been able to be comfortable with those who want to construct the architect of heaven and imagery. I think, you know, there are places where our symbols and our words just run out, and we have to just simply accept in faith that love holds us now, and love holds us always. And love can do things that I can't even imagine.
Well, another listener asked about Reiner, who was an atheist. Many in the Christian sector believe that people like him go to hell, and at the same time believe that people like Jerry Falwell Jr. go to heaven. How do you square that?
I don't square it. That's not my theology at all. That's a kind of a three-tier universe, earth in the middle, heaven above, hell below, reward and punishment system. I don't buy any of that. I simply believe that God is love, and that that love is reaching into our lives every moment that we live. It's a part. It's in every molecule that we are, and that ultimately that love brings us into union with itself in a way that, again, we don't have adequate symbols or words to express the beauty of. But we will be at one with God, ultimately. Every one of us.
877-217-5757, James in Metairie. James, you're on with Reverend Chris Andrews.
Well, yeah, good morning, Jim, and to your guest. The question was asked, how does government or should government be involved in marriage? Look at the tax tables. A single payer starts in a certain bracket at $85,000. If you're married, that particular bracket starts at twice that amount. The government has injected themselves into it financially for benefits, for example. You know, whether or not you're married or single, and all these people on the Christian conservatives were fighting for years to deny government benefits to gay and lesbian citizens of this country. It's wrong. It's discriminatory. And thankfully, it looks like we're moving in the right direction.
All right. Thank you, James. Reverend Andrews?
Well, yeah, James is correct. Discriminatory indeed, and we should never allow that. That's not my point about government and being involved in marriage. It has to do with who defines what is marriage. And I'm simply saying that's a faith community's role, and that marriage happens when two people... I'll give you an example. I have had, as a minister, the request to officiate at marriages for older people who, if they signed a license, would be financially penalized because of, you know, prior marriages and property inheritance and all of that. I did that fine, and there was no license to be signed. But were they married when the ceremony was done, when they'd spoken those words? You better believe it. They were as marriage could be. And that's what I'm trying to get at. Now, what James is referencing is a whole other dimension, very important dimension. And, you know, I, like him, I think, applaud the fact that the discriminatory practices against same-sex marriages or other people who just get sort of left out, those are wrong.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Reverend Andrews.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yeah, I understand that, according to Albert Einstein, that that love is the strongest force in the universe, and he believed that, and he also believed in God. But there are those who think that God judged New Orleans by sending Katrina there.
All right, what about those? In fact, Jerry Falwell Sr. was one of those. Thought that we were being punished for the weekend of decadence, or whatever they call it. What do you think?
And what survived Katrina in New Orleans better than anything else but the French Quarter, ground zero for the decadence. So, again, that's a theology that I just don't buy into. This idea that there's this righteous judge that just can't wait to punish people for their misdeeds. No. We need to get away from that, and we need to turn toward love. Love, as the book of Ecclesiastes says, love makes all things beautiful in the end.
Well, Reverend Andrews, always a pleasure to talk with you, and we look forward to seeing you in Baton Rouge. He's in North Carolina for a few days, but be safe, and we will catch up soon. But appreciate
your
insights today, as always. Thank you.
You to you and your listeners.
877-217-5757, back after this brief pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. Linda Woolard is with us, Pride of New Orleans, and she is trying to become the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party, and she is opposed by Katie Bernhardt of Lafayette. We've invited both of them to be on, and Katie declined, saying that she would come on after the vote, but she felt like she had the votes to become the chair. Linda, you think otherwise. Why do you believe you've got a fighting chance to win this election?
I think people want options. Jim, thanks for having me on, by the way, longtime listener. I think people want options in this race, and so there, I was contacted by so many people who wanted to make sure that there was a different candidate for them to vote for. That, and as I'm talking to people, we know more and more that there are folks who wanted to make sure they had an opportunity to vote for someone else. So just wanted to make sure people had that option. I know that they've thought they've had the votes for, and look, Katie's been running for many months. I am running a 2-week campaign that started when Representative James dropped out. So they've thought they had votes for quite a long time. By my vote count as of a couple weeks ago, I did not see that as the case.
Okay. Well, you're getting support in a lot of places, particularly from what is regarded as the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Lamar
right.
White on his Facebook page has put a glowing endorsement for you as his choice to be the party chair, saying he first met you in 2009. Can you tell us a bit about your background?
Sure. So I really got involved in politics after Hurricane Katrina hit South Louisiana, as we were trying to recover from that hurricane and the flood more than anything. I just noticed as we were, and you know, everyone in New Orleans was involved in the rebuilding, but I just noticed that we really weren't going to be able to make it if we didn't have more federal help. And without an ally in the White House, we just were not going to survive. So that's when I got involved with Barack Obama's campaign in early 2007, right as he got in. He'd visited New Orleans many times in the recovery and had talked about what he'd like to do to help recover. And that was, in fact, really important to New Orleans. Both Barack Obama and Joe Biden helped our region recover quite a bit, forgave a lot of loans.
Mm-hmm.
So that was how I got involved initially. But I've been involved. I stayed involved with Barack Obama through to his reelection, worked very diligently on passing the Affordable Care Act with his organization, Organizing for America. After 2012, when he got reelected, I went and worked at the Louisiana Democratic Party for 3 years, working on building a grassroots network of activists there in 2013. We worked on Mary Landrieu's campaign in 2014 and John Bell's campaign in 2015. The following year, I was state director for Hillary Clinton's campaign here in Louisiana. Did a lot of work with resistance groups in 2017 after Trump got elected. 2018, worked with the Unanimous Juries Coalition to pass the law, the amendment that took away the law that said a non-unanimous jury could convict someone of a felony in our state, which was a just old discriminatory practice.
All right. Well, you'll be involved in some partisan matters if you are the chair in a different way, and you'll be passing judgment on people. And a listener asked about this scandal, and I would view it as a scandal involving Congressman Scalise. It's such that picking up the New York Times Friday of last week on its op-ed page, this was the major essay. It is disturbing enough, writes the Times, that American democracy is being threatened by disinformation, the proliferation of which is facilitated by the shadier side of modern technology, phony websites, social media bots, manipulated video and audio, digitally fabricated deep fakes. How painful to be reminded that among the bad actors spreading such chaos and division are prominent elected officials sworn to serve the public. Representative Steve Scalise, the Louisiana Republican, shared a video clip featuring Andy Barkin, a progressive activist, asking Joe Biden to "We agree that we can redirect some of the funding for police," to which Mr. Biden responded, "Yes, absolutely," except that Mr. Barkin, who has ALS and communicates with the aid of a computerized voice, had not included the words "for police." And the Times says the words were spliced by Mr. Scalise's team, making it seem as though Mr. Biden was expressing direct support for defunding the police, something he explicitly opposes, no matter how loudly Republicans complain otherwise. Mr. Biden's criminal justice plan, in fact, includes $300 million in additional funding for police departments. So, obviously, Steve Scalise was caught in a lie doing so in a presidential election that in which honesty is an issue or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts? Oops, and we lost Katie for a moment. So hopefully we can get her back, because this is serious business, and the Times, in a very passionate editorial, says the spread of disinformation is a danger to the nation, one likely to get worse before it gets better. Since we can't rely on the responsibility of individual actors or the platforms they use, I fully expect there will be a proliferation of these sorts of fictions to a degree that nearly drowns out actual facts, warned Senator Ron Wyden, the Oregon Democrat, in 2018 about the rise of video manipulation tools. Congress needs to get serious about discouraging its own ranks from fueling the problem. That from the New York Times, and this was from Steve Scalise, who doctored a video of a man with ALS. Now, Steve Scalise, of course, is an American hero coming back from being shot at a baseball game involving his congressional colleagues and made a heroic comeback. But this is beyond the pale. Does he deserve to be rebuked for this? Linda, what do you think?
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry, I got disconnected briefly. Yes, I hopefully heard everything you were talking about. This is going to be more and more of an issue with politics, with, like you said, the deep fake videos and edited videos. And 100%, we have to speak out against that. We've seen cyber attacks on our systems, our voting systems, our voter vehicle systems. We just can't have folks be able to manipulate videos or do these kind of hackings. I think it's all interrelated. And the party needs to be strong enough to be able to train our members on how to push back on that, on how to message against that, and prove, you know, be able to respond when they're making false attacks that are heinous in this way of just pushing out clearly false information. So the party does need to be strong enough to stand up against that, rebuke, you know, evidence of that being done, and create the systems that will be used to better protect all of our candidates, our DPEC, our DSCC, all of our party players.
Now, the story of last week that gained much momentum late in the week, and for good reason, and it has not been debunked. In fact, it has been confirmed by some people, although anonymously, and that is an issue, and maybe for good reason, although anonymous sourcing has been around for many years. It was used effectively in the Watergate era. But what about the president allegedly saying that people who served in Vietnam and in other wars and got killed were losers and suckers? What do you think?
It sounds an awful lot like things he's already said on the record to me. And so it sounds fairly credibly sourced, even if it has been not identified who the source was. There's no one that's been in his environment besides his communications folks who have denied this. People who have served with him, the generals who served in his administration who are no longer there, have all said similar things.
And the president himself, back in 1998 on the Howard Stern show, was basically puffing his chest about how he got out of Vietnam and how he was doing other things during that time, and that not getting VD was his personal Vietnam. Here is the president with Howard Stern.
Now, getting back to dating, right? And when you got to say to a woman, hey, listen, you got to go to my personal doctor, and I'm going to have you checked out. Is that a tough thing to say to a woman, or you just got the balls to say it?
You know, I'll tell you, it's amazing. I can't even believe it. I've been so lucky in terms of that whole world.
Because you've never gotten a social disease.
It is a dangerous world out there.
It is.
Scary. It's like Vietnam, the Vietnam era.
It is your personal Vietnam, isn't it?
It is my personal
It is. You've
Vietnam.
Said that many
I feel
times.
Like a great and very brave soldier.
A lot of guys who went through Vietnam came out unscathed. A lot of guys who've gone through the 80s having sex with different women came out with AIDS and all kinds of things.
They survived Vietnam.
This is better than Vietnam, but it's...
All right, there's the president. Of course, it was the Howard Stern show, but nonetheless saying that not getting VD was his personal Vietnam.
I mean, this isn't a serious person. And, you know, he's not shown respect for our military. He used them as props. He, denigrated John McCain's service. Prisoners of war in general. He said if you got caught that he doesn't really have a whole lot of respect for you, you're losers. He said all of those things publicly. I just don't see how it's even a question that he may have said these things about the fallen soldiers of our war. So I don't know. I don't know how we respect that. And certainly that's information that we need to get out to people and make sure people know. But we also need to show them a vision of a better America and a better Louisiana. We need to be offering people something to look up to. And so it's great for us to push back about those things and expose Republicans for the lies they're telling or just the disrespect they're showing to troops or whatever. But we also need to be able to show them a vision of something that they can look forward to and ways to improve their day-to-day lives.
All right, we do have to roll, but thank you, Linda Woolard. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay safe and stay tuned.